This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Heroin Diaries, A Year in the Life of a Shattered Rock Star by Nikki Six with Ian Gittins. Read by Nikki Six with Sophie Kargman and Ross Marquand.
Ten years later. I was born on December 11th, 1958. But I fell in love with drugs and alcohol for the first time when I was 6 years old. By that time, I had accepted the fact that I would never have a real dad. But it's no secret, my mom didn't have a problem bringing men around to try to fill that void, even if it was for herself and not me. I don't have a lot of memories of my childhood. I think in a lot of ways, I blocked most everything out. Or all of my disappointments just ran into each other, creating a blur like trying to take a photo while moving. In the summer of 1965, my mom and stepdad got the bright idea to drive into Mexico and dragged me along because, well, they didn't have any other place to dump me. My memories of that trip across the border include my stepdad's Volkswagen Carmengia, his German Shepherd named Bell, and a shitload of marijuana. I don't remember much else about that trip other than feeling pretty marginalized due to the fact that my mom paid more attention to my stepdad than she did to me. But the one thing that sticks out the most is that it created a very clear before and after in my life, a line in the sand. One night, I sat on the floor in our rundown motel south of Guadalajara, playing with my only toy, a Tonka truck that was so beat up from wear and tear, a secondhand store probably wouldn't even take it for free. My mom and stepdad sat at a little table by the window, laughing hysterically while smoking a huge joint, probably some low-grade grass they'd come to Mexico to buy and later sneak north across the border under the hood of the car. They both sipped Jack Daniels from the motel's bathroom glasses without ice, which I remember thinking was strange. Who would want any kind of drink without ice in a heat like that? Next thing I knew, my stepdad was telling me to come over to him and that I should try to take a hit off the joint and take a sip of the whiskey. I don't remember feeling afraid. To the contrary, I wanted to show them both I was a grown-up and that I think I also wanted my mom to know I could do all the grown-up things that my shitty stepdad could do. Once the pot and whiskey hit my system, my mind went kaboom and my whole world changed. The static in my head, my body that I felt all day, every day, just went away. Like turning the channel on a TV from only seeing snow and then getting the clearest picture that you've ever seen. Everything made sense, and I no longer had any fear or sadness or doubt or anger about anything left in the world. At that point, everything in my life became about chasing that feeling. To this day, it has never stopped, no matter how much work I do on myself. People who have never struggled with addiction have a very different perspective on what it means to recover from a lifestyle of abuse. The fact is, they say you are in recovery because it is impossible to fully get better. Once the switch flips in your brain, you will never be one of the people who can, as they say in Alcoholics Anonymous, drink like a gentleman. The ability for an addict to responsibly drink and use drugs is a very dangerous misnomer. A lot of addicts fall prey to the notion that after a period of time they are cured and it's okay to go back out and give it another try. Perhaps some have succeeded in this exercise, but I've never met one of these people. In the case of heroin addiction, I do know that those in recovery who end up relapsing often overdose and die because their bodies and brains are just not used to the volume of drugs in their system anymore. Even though I relapsed after the events described in the Heroin Diaries, I never tried heroin again, and I'm afraid that if I had, I might have been just another statistic. Since the publication of the Heroin Diaries, my status as a recovery guy has gone through an evolution. When I meet and talk to other addicts, I sometimes feel that I'm viewed as some kind of Superman, a guy who's evolved completely through his recovery and has reached a weird kind of recovery enlightenment. This couldn't be further from the truth. On paper, the 10 years since the publication of the Heroin Diaries has been really incredible for me. Motley Crue had some of the biggest tours of their career. 6AM was formed and had a number of hits and tours. I released two additional New York Times best-selling books. I created America's biggest syndicated rock radio show. I got married to an amazing woman, and I've become a professional photographer. But the truth is, the last 10 years have been in some ways the hardest years of my life, both professionally and personally. Life is constantly throwing things in your direction that you don't anticipate. And I'd be lying if I said there weren't times during the past decade where I didn't feel the pull of the bottle as a solution to my problems. And I thank God I never succumbed. A lot of people I've met through the last 10 years thank me for the Heroin Diaries and say that it saved their lives. The truth is, the Heroin Diaries saved my life too. Since its publication, I felt a responsibility to the recovery community that I've never felt before. A responsibility to maintain my sobriety because I am an example for others. But I am not infallible, and that is a very crucial fact that I hope people understand. When the Heroin Diaries came out in 2007, I took a real deep breath. It felt weird to hold it in my hands. There it was, a year in my life, laid bare to the world. A part of me thought, okay, cool, this is the natural progression from what I've always done. Be totally honest and candid in my interviews. Like the Home Sweet Home lyric says, my heart is like an open book for the whole world to read. Then the private part of me thought, what the hell was I thinking? Because most people don't keep diaries in which they itemize their most desperate and degrading moments, in which they talk about going insane, injecting dope into their dicks in the bedroom closet. Most people don't write diaries about life so decadent that they end up dead from an overdose. And most people definitely don't publish those tales of madness for everybody to read. I was given a second chance, and those are rare when it comes to drugs. I knew in my heart that sharing details, no matter how gory, was important to relay to the next person who'd face the demon. I knew people who did get that second chance, people who didn't make it out alive. I had friends who were rotting right in front of my eyes. Maybe my story could help people looking for just a glimmer of hope. So when it came to publishing the Heroin Diaries, honesty was the only rule. Otherwise, people can smell a rat. I didn't want to see people suffer anymore from this deadly disease if I could help. Addiction doesn't just affect the addicted, it also destroys their family and friends. Now, I knew Motley Crue fans would buy this book, but I hope more it would connect with addicts or people looking to get into recovery, and I'd hope it might shed some light on the nature of addiction. I couldn't think of a better reason to show my warts and all. When I got a phone call from my management team the week the Heroin Diaries was released in September of 2007, I was shocked to find out that my story had found mainstream appeal. Hey, Nikki, they told me, your book is on the New York Times bestseller list, top 10. I'll never forget seeing that New York Times list. In fact, I still have it framed on my bathroom wall. There was my reality right up there near the top. I remember it was next to books by Bill Clinton and Mother Teresa. Good God, Mother Teresa is probably rolling in her grave over that one. So why did the Heroin Diaries touch so many people? It's not the first book ever written about addiction. I guess it had to do with the fact that I held nothing back. I never pulled my punches lyrically, musically, or in interviews. Addiction is usually handled in quiet. We sin in silence, so to speak. Once you admit that you're powerless, you'll find other people who want to change their lives for the better, too. Alcoholics Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, it's all about being anonymous. You go to these rooms and you say, these are the things I've done, and today I am one day sober. It's a place to confess, a secret sanctuary with no judgment. This book, though, was the exact opposite. You can't get much less secretive than publishing your diaries. Now, maybe people connected to the Heroin Diaries because I was confessing things that they may have done or somebody they loved might have done some of those things. Maybe it helped people not feel so alone. All I know is when the book came out, the phone calls started coming in. We want to talk to Nikki on this TV show or that radio show or in the news. I was taken aback at how much interest there was. It all opened up a conversation that I'd never had in public before. Luckily, I found the discussion easy. It was like purging, pulling the scab off the wound and letting it breathe. I guess in many ways, that was the point of the book. Honesty was the key to all the conversations. People started to confess to me like I'd done to them in the book. It was a beautiful thing. The idea behind the Heroin Diaries was to show addiction, but also show recovery. I knew a lot of people might pick the book up for an inside look at my lifestyle, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but I hope that even if somebody did read it for that reason, by the time they got to the end, their heart was a little warmer. My old sponsor said life is about softening the heart. If the reader had a greater understanding of where excess can lead and how to find the light in all that darkness, then I did more than publish another rock and roll book. I didn't mind being the worm on the hook. If this was how I could get people to consume the information, that was fine by me. I did book signings, and they were crazier than some concerts that I've been to. The crowds were way larger than anticipated. In Chicago, we thought there'd be a riot as it came time for us to leave for the airport because there were still so many people who wanted their books signed. Washington, D.C.'s crowd wouldn't let me go, and I signed books until 1 o'clock in the morning. The signings were very emotional. I connected with a new audience in a way I'd never done before. A lot of people who got their hands on the Heroin Diaries right at the start were dealing with their own addictions. They were either getting off or wanting to get off heroin, cocaine, pills, or alcohol. At these signings, these people were immediately recognizable and didn't hesitate to tell me face to face, as they knew that I understood exactly what they were going through. They knew that I'd been there, and they knew that I somehow got out. There were even people coming to those first signings that were sweating and shaking and saying, "I've been clean for 6 days." I would think to myself, this book has only been out for 7 days. People at signings started to give me their chips. When you're in a recovery program, you're first given a newcomer chip. Then if you stay sober, you get chips at 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, a year, and so on. People who had been in the program for years were giving me their tokens that they had worked so hard to earn. It was an honor to receive those chips, and it still is to this day. Now, the other way people heard about the Heroin Diaries, of course, was through a new project I'd put together just for the book called 6 AM. 6 AM was originally just going to be a one-off musical project with no band name based around the book. My manager had the idea of recording 5 or 6 songs based on the Heroin Diaries to put on a CD and slip inside the back cover, a soundtrack to a book. I was already writing with James Michael, and Alan Kovac, my manager of more than 20 years, put me in touch with DJ Ashba. So I showed the guys my old diaries and the new galleys of the book and asked if they wanted to embark on a crazy journey. Writing a soundtrack to a book was something that had never been done before. It set us free musically and lyrically because there was nothing to compare it against. It was really exciting to be in uncharted waters. Between the three of us, magic began to happen. We wrote Life is Beautiful, and in keeping with the honesty of the book, I knew the song had to hold truth. It had this line, "There's nothing like a funeral to make you feel alive." It cut like a knife as James sang it. Then Accidents Can Happen was about those times I was trying to get sober but would slip, and people would say to me, "You're a bad person. Be stronger. What's wrong with you?" And I would say, "Man, accidents can happen," as this lyric clearly paints. And you know that accidents can happen, and it's okay. We all fall off the wagon sometimes. It's not your whole life. It's only one day. We gave these songs to Alan Kovac, and he played them for radio programmers all around the world. Kovac came back and said, "They love these tracks. They're saying Life is Beautiful could connect in a big way. So now you need a band name," he added. "Huh?" I said to him. "These are tracks to go in the back of a book. We don't need a band name." "No," he said. "You're going to be a band. You're going to put out an album, and you're probably going to be asked to tour. You need a band name." So 6 AM was born, as was our first album, The Heroin Diaries Soundtrack. The album and book were about to change my life forever and many others. It's interesting how it all connected. Some people read the book and then got into the band, and some people heard the songs, got intrigued, and then went back and got the book. To this day, I still hear stories of people listening to the album and reading the book at the same time. It's not often that people make it. I got to see the world in one of the biggest bands in the world with Motley Crue, but to strike twice is rare. The second time, though, wasn't about fame, money, or drugs. It was about heart and, yes, honesty. When the book first came out, I went to Washington, D.C. to meet with U.S. Congressman Patrick Kennedy at the Capitol to discuss how health insurers might do better to provide coverage for health and addiction issues. I got invited to speak on Capitol Hill for National Recovery Month, which was humbling, but it let me reach more people too. That speech was for the people who were trapped in the same awful dark place that I was back when I was scribbling those diary entries, and straight away I realized that they were hearing me. I was getting through. I started getting emails and letters from people fighting addiction to thank me for the book. They told me they hadn't known what to expect before they read it. They laughed, they cried, and it motivated them. I'd been in Motley Crue for more than 25 years by 2007. The Heroin Diaries was the biggest and most intense response of anything I had done in my life, easily. And all this was coming from some shattered rock star shooting up and scratching his broken thoughts in an old journal some 20 years earlier. When 6 a.m. started playing live, I saw fans down at the front of the shows crying when we played Accidents Can Happen. I'd look over at this amazing band I had with James Michael and DJ Ashba, and I felt like the luckiest man on earth. Not only was I sober, I was in a band unlike anything I had experienced before. We were different, and we were friends, too. Then after the shows, fans would tell me, "I'm trying so hard. There are so many people around me who don't understand. The book and the songs are helping me on my journey." To be honest, it was humbling and overwhelming and a lot to take in. I started to feel a lot of responsibility. It weighed on me in a positive way. I suddenly had a bigger responsibility than just being another cool cat in a rock band. There'd always been a part in Motley Crue shows when Vince would say, "I want to introduce Mr. Nikki Six," and hand me the microphone. The crowd would yell and I would say, "Whoa, yeah, come on, put your hands in the fucking air and let's rock." It's all part of the sacred ritual. After the Heroin Diaries, that all changed. Vince would introduce me, I would grab the mic from him, and the arena would fall silent. I felt like I had to say something really important. It wasn't enough anymore to shout, "Yeah, let's all have a good time tonight," but what was I supposed to do instead? I had no idea, and in fact, I actually went to Vince and asked him to stop doing it. He told me, "You have to, bro. People want to hear from you." I love Vince for that. In the end, I started thinking for a second before opening my mouth and seeing what came out. I realized just how much my book had meant to people, and I realized that I couldn't let them down. When it first came out, there was a news story that a teacher in the Midwest had given it to his class to read as a salutary story about drugs and addiction. One of the pupil's parents had seen the book, been horrified, and complained to the school, which had suspended the teacher. Now, 10 years have passed since we published The Heroin Diaries, and I'm proud that the book is in a lot of school libraries. I'm even more proud that some rehab centers give it to their recovering addicts to help them. I can't think of a better use for it. Now, of course, a lot has happened since then. Some of the people who have helped me tell my story the first time are no longer around. Some of their deaths were due to drugs that they took years or even decades earlier. Because that's the way drugs sometimes roll. Even when you beat them, they can still get you in the end. In the Heroin Diaries, I poured a lot of blame for my broken heart and trauma all over my parents. As I saw it, I reckoned that if they had not abandoned me, I'd never have plumbed the insane depths of addiction that my unhappiness took me to. Was I right? Yes and no. If I had a perfect story like childhood, well, maybe I would have avoided the rotting, decaying lifestyle that ended up killing me. Sure, it's possible. Or maybe I wouldn't have. Maybe something else would have dragged me down there. You just never know. Some of my friends have said if I wasn't angry, maybe I wouldn't have thrown myself headfirst into rock and roll the way I did either. I guess we can thank my childhood for Shout at the Devil. My mom, Deanna Richards, passed away. We tried to mend our broken relationship, but we never quite managed it. Like I said, she was never really there throughout my childhood, whether that was her fault or somebody else's doesn't really matter anymore. She's gone now. All I can say is if you have time to make amends, make them. We both should have. Being sober is also about being accountable. I wanted so much to get real with my mom. I wanted to talk it all out with her and try to mend things. I think if my mom had ever just said to me, at any time in recent years, I fucked up. Well, I would have said right back to her, Mom, I fucked up too. Let's start over. But she never did. She couldn't or wouldn't. Whenever we tried to talk, she'd say the same old things, that she was mistreated, that she was the victim, that people had tried to take me from her because she was the black sheep of the family. As far as my mom was concerned, she'd never done anything wrong. It kind of left our conversation with nowhere to go. The only way to progress it would be if I had said, yes, you're right. Everything that happened in my life was my fault, or my grandmother Nona's fault, or my grandfather Tom's fault. I couldn't say that because it wasn't true. She had a part in it. Plus, I just don't operate like that. I'll meet you halfway, but you have to meet me too. So even so, I tried to mend things with my mom. Courtney, my wife, would push me. She'd tell me, you need to go up to Seattle to see your mother, Nikki. She won't be around forever. About a year before my mom passed, I flew up to Seattle with my kids and Courtney to meet up with her. It was in a Four Seasons hotel, and she was pissed off because she couldn't smoke inside. We talked, and I said, Mom, I've been on the road a lot, and I think I might take it easy for a while now. My mom looked at me and said, well, you better not be thinking about retiring anytime soon. Everybody in the room sat with bated breath. Me? I'd seen this movie before. For a second, I thought she would say, because you're so talented, or because you've made so many people happy. I thought my mother was about to say something nice. Instead, she looked me square in the eye and she said, because I'm going to need about $40,000 per month to be taken care of in the kind of facility that I want to be in. And all I could think to say was, oh. I looked at the floor where my wife and kids sat around me in silence. Just when I thought my mother couldn't hurt me anymore, she shattered my heart into 1,000 pieces one last time. That evening, we went for dinner, and my mom spent the entire meal telling the people at the table all the great things she did for me as a child. I guess some of them may have been true. But as the night went on, I found myself looking at her and thinking, well, I guess this is how the story ends. And it was. We never got to get real. It's a shame, but it just wasn't to be. My grandfather Tom was a different story. When my grandfather passed away, it broke my heart. Right to the end, he was coming to stay with us in Los Angeles, and even when he was not feeling good, he'd never go see a doctor. That's how he was. He was born in 1927. He thought doctors were criminals. Same with lawyers, politicians, and anybody from the church. That was Tom. He owned it. He got prostate cancer, and by the time he finally saw his doctor in Idaho, it had spread throughout his body, and it was too late. I was with him when he took his last gasp. I miss him still to this day. He and Nona, they made me. They gave me a soft heart. They're the good that's in me. When I lose my compassion and my anger rears its ugly head, I think about my life with them, and it brings me back down to earth. I grew up in a trailer. We had no money, but I was a billionaire in my heart, thanks to their unconditional love. Nona and Tom were my mom and my dad. It was hard for me when addiction specialist Bob Timmons passed away. Now, there was a drug counselor who made a difference. What a life Bob had had. He had been a really bad addict, spent time in jail, ridden with the Hell's Angels, was covered in tattoos, and chain-smoked until cancer got him. But he had long since turned his life around. He lived for helping people. Bob did so much for me, and he never asked for a dime for any of it. If it wasn't for Bob, about 10 bands that I know wouldn't be here to make music for us. He was a tattooed badass angel. Vanity, past two. She and I never spoke after the Heroin Diaries came out, and I'm not sure we'd have that much to say to each other. It was so strange how she passed and then Prince passed right after her. Maybe they are in purple heaven together right now. Lemmy wrote that cool short medical dictionary for the original Heroin Diaries, and we always stayed in contact. He would text me, just simple stuff, telling me that he loved me. We played shows together and hung out in the dressing room. He'd play me old music on cassettes. He loved rock and roll, and it loved him. If more people were like Lemmy, we'd have less assholes on Earth. I saw Lemmy about 2 months before he passed. He was walking with a cane and looked so frail and thin, I'd never seen him so thin. He came up to me right into my face, and he said, "Nicky, look at me. I don't like the way I look. I look like an old man." I told him, "Lemmy, you look fine, man. You're going to get through this." But just a few weeks, he was gone. I will never forget him. He was the spirit of being real. Honesty all rolled up with a rock and roll snarl. So now they're all gone, and somehow I'm still here. I'm happy, sober, married, loving my family and my life. I'm here for my kids. I don't wake up craving a drink or drugs every day. But that doesn't mean I'm perfect or everything is easy. I'm still in recovery, and I always will be. There was this guy that I used to write about in my journals 30 years ago, Sicky Nicks. He was my alter ego. I blamed that dude for a fuck of a lot. Anytime I would shoot up or drank myself insane, cheated, stole, lied, well, that's Sicky's fault. Sicky has always been with me. I remember once when I was 9 years old, some kids were picking on me on a school bus. We got off the bus, I filled my lunchbox with rocks, swung, hit the first kid right across the face, then I hit the second kid. They never picked on me again. That was Sicky. That was 50 years ago. 50 years. He is a fucking monster. He's been around for half a century. And he's a Heroin Diaries character who definitely isn't dead. Today, he comes out around anger. "You really have to poke me, but if you poke the rattlesnake enough times, Sicky will come out. I don't like him. I always feel poisoned after he shows up." Sicky had a wild time in the addiction years, when my mentality was, if you do me wrong, I'll do you dead. Even now, he won't totally go away. Wish he would. He's like Damien from The Omen. It's my battle to keep Sicky Nicks at bay. Before I was sober, I had no chance. Now, I mostly manage it. Mostly. Time moves on. My oldest kids are now well into their 20s and almost the age I was when I was shooting, snorting, and drinking myself into the grave. Thank God they haven't taken after my destructive old habits. A couple years ago, I asked my eldest daughter, Storm, whether she had ever read the Heroin Diaries. "I tried to, but it was sort of boring," she told me. "It was just so redundant. You woke up, you did drugs. You went to sleep, you woke up, you did drugs. After a few chapters, I gave up." I laughed, and I was pleased she felt that way. Well, maybe I was a little hurt. I'm glad my kids are not in a drug culture. But I know they're lucky because right now America is suffering one of its worst heroin epidemics in decades. It's truly heartbreaking. I did an interview with a mortician on my Sixth Sense radio show, and he told me 500,000 people in the U.S. are now addicted to heroin. I read recently that the problem in Ohio is so bad that there are more bodies coming into the mortuary than they can hold. They have to bring in ICE trucks and send the bodies to other places while they figure out what happened to them and then to bury them. Think about it. That sounds apocalyptic. It's because of addiction. It's also a great reason to re-release this book right now. It's a good time to be warning people off heroin. A lot of the problem comes from scripts like oxycodone. People take the drugs for medical reasons. They get addicted or re-addicted, and when their doctors won't write any more prescriptions, they go to the streets or the internet and they buy it. They start smoking it and eventually shoot up. Then there's fentanyl, which users mix with lower-grade heroin to give it more of a kick. The heroin might be 100% pure when it leaves China, say, but when it gets to America, it's been stepped on, cut down multiple times. One dealer makes it 50%, the next makes it 25%, then another guy cuts it down to 10%. It ends up getting sold as dirty street China white heroin, but users know they can get fentanyl cheap and they mix it in. Makes the dope way more potent, and then they overdose and die. It's a dangerous situation. I worry about it daily. It was fentanyl that killed Prince. He was taking it to mask pain for his hip. I know how easily you can slip from prescription drugs to addiction. When I had a double hernia surgery on the last Motley Crue tour, the doctors gave me drugs for pain management. They said, take them every 4 hours. I did for a few days, but then I flushed them down the toilet because I didn't want to be a statistic. I know how good they feel, but I also know I didn't want them in my life ever again. As I write this, I have more surgeries coming up. My left and right rotator cuffs are torn on my shoulders. I just had to have my left hip replaced from jumping off amps for 35 years. I understand the need for pain management meds, but when I have them, I also know how wary I need to be around them. My reason for sharing this info is pain can be managed, but beware the lure of the devil. I know his face well. You should too. Maybe this book will help you or scare you. These are statistics that are different from when these diaries were written. Let's keep the information alive so people can stay alive. Nowadays, I wake up and don't have to worry about pills and cocaine, heroin and alcohol. I hardly even think about them. But it's important not to completely erase your past. This book won't let me ever forget it. That is for sure. People who are in recovery are often very comfortable when things are going well, when their life is good, when the sun is shining and they're cruising along. But as soon as things go wrong or life gets hard, their first thought is for a drink or a snort or a pill. I remember when I first tried to get sober, I didn't want to be not cool, to be the geek at the party. It took me a long time to be comfortable enough to be able to go to a party sober. Then I realized it doesn't matter how other people see me. I need to stay sober for me. And if it becomes a slippery situation where I feel uncomfortable in my skin or I start to think about drinking, it's time to leave. When I go to a party, I always have an escape route mapped out. Also because drunk people are fucking annoying. Over the past 10 years, there's been many times I've walked into a party or a room and people are on coke or fucked up or saying stupid shit. And I just say, well, gotta go now. Sorry, I have to leave early, but I got something to do early tomorrow. My life is more important than parties or party favors. I do okay as long as I stay with the program. When I was first getting clean and trying to wrap my head around the idea of not doing drugs, I used to go to AA meetings twice a day. Now I go once a week, less when I'm on the road, but I still talk to people in the program almost daily. There are some great apps out there, too, to help you stay on the path. I have a great AA app that pops up every day with something to read. I also have this app that tells me how long I've been sober. It all helps. As I write this, it reads, 15 years, 63 days, 182 months, 5,542 days, and about 133,000 hours, and I am not looking to reset that anytime soon. So why do I want to put these insane journal entries out there again 10 years after they first shocked and inspired so many people? The Heroin Diaries is the book that changed my life. But it also changed the lives of thousands of other people. I never realized, never began to imagine the impact it would have on so many people. Even today, I could be anywhere in the world and people will come up to me and one of the first things they want to talk about is the book. It happens in Russia, South America, Mexico. I was on holiday in Hawaii not too long ago, and there was a father sitting with his family by the pool. He was reading The Heroin Diaries. I might be at a rock festival in the middle of a dirt field in the UK, and someone will walk up to me holding the book. Every show I play with Motley Crue or 6 a.m., someone in the crowd will wave the book to me. When that happens, I know I made the right decision. I think, if you've read that book, you know my deepest, darkest secrets. You don't see me on stage like a rock star all glammed up. You know the real me, and I might even know you. There are people out there struggling with addiction right now in this latest epidemic who are in their teens and 20s. When The Heroin Diaries came out, they were only 8 or 10. It had passed them by. If this anniversary edition helps even one person get sober and stay alive, it'll be worth it. Because as I know well, when you're deep in that hole, you need all the help that you can get. When I look back on my chaotic, blurred, self-hating life of 30 years ago, I always think, I lived the life I wanted to live, and I died the life that I wanted to live. So strap in and enjoy this very bumpy ride. I hope you and those you love never go through anything like this. Now, welcome back to my personal horror story. By the way, it has a happy ending.
I never thought Nikki Sixx could live beyond the third Motley Crue album. People like me, Bowie, and Elton John were professional abusers, but Nikki went further than us. He used needles, which we never dared to do. I knew Jim Morrison well, and Nikki reminded me a lot of him. When Jim died at 27, we weren't shocked because he had died. We were shocked that he had got that far in the first place. Alice Cooper. A short medical dictionary. Definitions from Wikipedia.org. Addiction. Noun. A compulsion to repeat a behavior regardless of its consequences. A person who is addicted is sometimes called an addict. The term addiction describes a chronic pattern of behavior that continues despite the direct or indirect adverse consequences that result from engaging in the behavior. It is quite common for an addict to express the desire to stop the behavior but find himself unable to cease. Addiction is often characterized by a craving for more of the drug or behavior, increased physiological tolerance to exposure, and withdrawal symptoms in the absence of the stimulus. Many drugs and behaviors that provide either pleasure or relief from pain pose a risk of addiction or dependency. Alcoholism. Noun. A term that describes the excessive and often chronic consumption of alcohol. Among the characteristics of alcoholism are compulsion and addiction. It can also be characterized as an illness or allergy, and many believe it to be a biological disease. Cocaine. Noun. Cocaine is a crystalline tropane alkaloid that is obtained from the leaves of the coca plant. It is a stimulant of the central nervous system and an appetite suppressant, creating what has been described as a euphoric sense of happiness and increased energy. Cocaine is highly addictive, and its possession, cultivation, and distribution is illegal for non-medicinal, non-government sanctioned purposes in virtually all parts of the world. Depression. Noun. Clinical depression is a state of sadness or melancholia that has advanced to the point of being disruptive to an individual's social functioning and or activities of daily living. Although a mood characterized by sadness is often colloquially referred to as depression, clinical depression is something more than just a temporary state of sadness. Symptoms lasting 2 weeks or longer and of a severity that begins to interfere with typical social functioning and or activities of daily living are considered to constitute clinical depression. Clinical depression affects about 16% of the population on at least one occasion in their lives. The mean age of onset, from a number of studies, is in the late 20s. Clinical depression is currently the leading cause of disability in the U.S. as well as in other countries, and is expected to become the second leading cause of disability worldwide, after heart disease, by the year 2020. Heroin, noun, a semi-synthetic opioid. It is the 3.6-diacetyl derivative of morphine. Hence diacetylmorphine, and is synthesized from it by acetylation. The white crystalline form is commonly the hydrochloride salt, diacetylmorphine hydrochloride. It is highly addictive when compared to other substances. A few of the popular street names for heroin include dope, diesel, smack, skag, and H. Psychosis, noun. A generic psychiatric term for a mental state in which thought and perception are severely impaired. Persons experiencing a psychotic episode may experience hallucinations, hold delusional beliefs, e.g., paranoid delusions, demonstrate personality changes, and exhibit disorganized thinking. This is often accompanied by lack of insight into the unusual or bizarre nature of such behavior, difficulties with social interaction, and impairments in carrying out the activities of daily living. A psychotic episode is often described as involving a loss of contact with reality. Definitions provided by Dr. Lemuel Pillmeister, also known as Lemmy.
Addiction, when you can give up something at any time, as long as it's next Tuesday. Alcoholism, a habit that helps you see the iguanas in your eyeballs. Cocaine, Peruvian marching powder, a stimulant that has the extraordinary effect that the more you do, the more you laugh out of context. Depression, when everything you laugh at is miserable and you can't seem to stop. Heroin, a drug that helps you escape reality while making it much harder to cope when you are recaptured. Psychosis, when everyone turns into tiny dolls and they have needles in their mouths and they hate you and you don't care because you have the knife.
Key players in these torrid tales, otherwise known as partners in crime.
Nikki Six. The dying could be easy. It was the living that I didn't know if I could do.
Founder, chief songwriter, and bassist for Motley Crue. Assiduous diary keeper and the anti-hero of this tale. A man who was so hooked on heroin and cocaine that he had to die twice before he began to contemplate a more positive lifestyle.
Tommy Lee. We all went to that dark fucking place at various times, but Nikki seemed to like it there more than any of us. AKA T-Bone, Motley Crue's drummer and Nikki's toxic twin. A fellow narcotics adventurer who shared all of Nikki's 80s addictions, except heroin.
Vince Neil. Nikki was spending a lot of time shooting up in the bathroom during the girls' sessions, and that suited me fine. It was the perfect time for me to record my vocals.
The singer of Nikki's lyrics and Motley Crue, and a man who spent most of the 80s hating the guts of his band's songwriter and bassist. The feeling was mutual.
Mick Mars. When I heard Nikki was dead, my first reaction was, I knew that fucking prick was going to do something like that.
Unassuming and reclusive Motley Crue guitarist who was forced to accept that his role in life was to be bullied, persecuted, and abused by his vindictive bandmates.
Deanna Richards. You never imagine your own family will plot against you to steal your son.
Nikki's mother, who endured an agonizingly long estrangement from her son after his troubled and turbulent childhood.
Cece Comer. Nikki was rude, full of himself. He just crushed me so many times. He was an asshole.
Once adoring little sister of Nikki, who accepts that their particular in-family dynamic was maybe not your average sibling relationship.
Tom Reese. I went to stay with Nikki once or twice, and the way of life he had was not to my liking.
Nikki's maternal grandfather, who, together with his late wife Nona, looked after Nikki in Idaho for long periods of his youth.
Doc McGee. As a parting joke, I'd said to Nikki, don't send us any girls in Nazi helmets and Gestapo boots, and he must have thought I meant it because they turn up in helmets but not the boots.
Former Motley Crue co-manager who described the physical violence he sometimes meted out to his troublesome charges as full contact management.
Doug Thaler. Nikki showed me some gummy black substance he had that he claimed was some kind of exotic cocaine that he was going to snort. I thought, good luck snorting a gummy substance.
Partner to Doc McGee, and a man resigned to receiving early-hour phone calls from Nikki informing him that there were Mexicans and midgets in the bassist's garden.
Evangelist Denise Matthews. I don't answer to vanity. I would much rather be a fish
stuck in a pond with a starving shark than take on such a foul name of nothingness.
The artist formerly known as Vanity, former Prince pop protege and girlfriend who turned her affections to her on-again, off-again fiancé Nikki and a freebase cocaine before finding God and becoming a born-again preacher.
Tom Zutaut. Nikki told her he wasn't scared by a little bit of blood and proceeded to have intercourse with her right there.
Elektra Records A&R man who signed Motley Crue to the label and suffered the indignity of watching Nikki have sex with his girlfriend 3 minutes after he formally introduced them.
Fred Saunders. I hit Motley a lot. I once broke Tommy's nose in Indiana. I broke Nikki's ribs and I beat the shit out of Vince many times because he's an asshole.
Former Hell's Angel, supplier of Ace in the Hole, and the head of security on numerous Motley Crue world tours.
Bob Timmons. Cocaine gave Nikki acute paranoia and hallucinations. One night he called me and asked me to get the police over to his house right away because there were little men with helmets and guns in the trees surrounding his house.
Former junkie turned drugs counselor to the stars who fought countless valiant but losing battles to have Nikki admitted to rehab.
Slash. I hung out with Nikki and I found a sickening allure in his lifestyle. My junkie years were dirty and sordid, but Nikki seemed to me to have found a cool, glamorous way to be a junkie.
Guns N' Roses guitarist and the little brother that Nikki never had during GNR's infamous 1987 tour of the Deep South with Motley Crue.
Sally McLaughlin. Slash was paralytic and Nikki was turning blue.
Former girlfriend of Slash, who moved from Scotland to Los Angeles in 1987 and spent her first day in the city saving Nikki's life.
Karen Dumont. When I moved to Los Angeles, I was told not to even talk to Motley Crue because they were trouble.
Record company employee who took her work responsibilities so seriously that she moved into Nikki's house to try to keep him alive.
Bob Michaels. Once or twice I left my pipe out on the counter and when I wasn't looking, Nikki sprinkled heroin in it.
Friend, neighbor, and occasional companion in Nikki's rock and roll misadventures.
Ross Halfen. I always said that Tommy should have married Nikki, because if they were gay, they would be the ideal gay couple. Made in heaven.
British photographer who has photographed Motley Crue for nearly 20 years and still thinks Nikki is a likable, selfish, paranoid control freak.
Jason Bryce. Nikki phoned down the reception and said, look, I'm Nikki Six. I need a bottle of JD now, and I will give you $1,000 for it. They just told him, sir, go to bed. You've had enough.
Callow British teenager who went on the road with Motley Crue as a boy and returned as a man.
Bryn Bridenthal. One of the early things Nikki used to do was set himself on fire during interviews.
Motley Crue publicist who knew nothing about heroin in the 80s, but today, having worked with Nirvana and Courtney Love, is much better informed.
Tim Lutzy. On my first day, Nikki came into the studio with a black eye, having spent the night in a police cell. That pretty much set the tone for what was to follow.
Nikki's bass tech for 10 years, an occupation that occasionally involved enforced Jack Daniels drinking while garbed in the robes of a priest.
Joe Scaleri. Tommy pulled his cock out and started banging it against the desk.
Canadian record company executive who, as a young DJ named Joey Vendetta, hosted one of the most outrageous radio interviews in rock and roll history.
Wayne Isham. Nikki always had the devil's wise-ass smile in his eyes. I guess that's why he always wore sunglasses.
Director of scores of award-winning music videos by the likes of Motley Crue, Ozzy Osbourne, Metallica, Britney Spears, and Nikki's personal favorite, Bon fucking Jovi.
Alan Kovac. Nikki Six may never win a Grammy because the industry does not always judge on talent, but he deserves many.
Head of Los Angeles-based 10th Street Management and current manager of Motley Crue, who helped to negotiate their escape from Elektra Records.
Sylvia Roan. Would I like to take part in this book? I don't think it would be appropriate.
Former CEO of Elektra Records who figured Motley Crue was spent in the late 90s and sold them the master tapes of their albums.
Rick Nielsen. Nikki Six was a big teddy bear with a nice smile. He could barely play the bass, mind you, but that never stopped Gene Simmons.
Cheap Trick guitarist and Nikki's boyhood hero, friend, and occasional touring and drinking companion.
Bob Rock. Nikki and Tommy decided to dress as Canadian lumberjacks. They put on lumberjack shirts and false mustaches.
A-list rock producer of Motley's Dr. Feelgood and Motley Crue albums, plus records by Aerosmith, Metallica, Bryan Adams, and Bon Jovi.
James Michael. Nikki is a very creative and talented guy, and he thinks in a very dark and twisted way.
Nikki's erstwhile songwriting partner with whom he has co-written hits for Meatloaf and Saliva.
Introduction 1. When I was 15 years old, I remember Iggy and the Stooges' song Search and Destroy reaching out from my speakers like my own personal anthem. It was a theme I would carry for decades as my own hell-bent mantra. That song might as well have been tattooed across my knuckles because there could be no truer words for a young, alienated teenager. I'm a street-walking cheetah with a heart full of napalm. I'm a runaway son of a nuclear A-bomb. I'm a world's forgotten boy. Alice Cooper was another musical hero. Like Nostradamus, Alice must have seen the future when he sang, "Welcome to my nightmare," or at least my future. Welcome to my nightmare. Welcome to my breakdown. I hope I didn't scare you. Yet Alice's nightmare was show business. This book is something else entirely. This is me welcoming you to a genuine living nightmare that I endured nearly 20 years ago. A nightmare that was so bad that it ended up killing me. But now I know it wasn't only the drugs, it was also my past unknowingly haunting me, and even a lethal combination of narcotics couldn't seem to kill the pain. I guess we could mix these two songs together, you'd have the theme song of my adolescence. On Christmas Day 1986, I was a member of one of the biggest rock and roll bands in the world. I was also an alcoholic, a coke addict, a heroin addict, heading into a pill-popping downward spiral of depression. Welcome to my nightmare. Musically, I always thought Motley Crue was a nasty combination of rock, punk, glam, and pop sprinkled together with lots of sarcasm, anger, and humor, love, and hate, happiness, and sadness. Of course, depending on the recipe, there were always larger or smaller amounts of sex in there, too. I mean, what is rock and roll if it's not sexy? Sleazy, usually. Chauvinist, always. We crammed it all into a blender, and out came a very toxic cocktail. Palatable for the masses like Jim Jones' Kool-Aid. Sweet to the lips and deadly to ourselves, we were the drug scouts of America, and we were louder than hell. These diaries start on Christmas Day 1986, but that day wasn't even that special. I was an addict well before then, and stayed one for a while afterwards. Perhaps that day just brought my condition home to me. There's something about spending Christmas alone, naked, sitting by a Christmas tree, gripping a shotgun that lets you know your life is spinning dangerously out of control. I'm a street-walking cheetah with a heart full of napalm. People over the years have tried to soften the blow by saying, maybe being in Motley Crue turned me into an addict. But I don't think it did. That stroke of genius was all my own work. Even as a kid, I was never inclined to dodge a bullet. I was always the first one to take it right between the eyes. I was stubborn, strong-willed, and always willing to put myself in harm's way for the betterment of chaos, confusion, and rebellion. All the traits that made me famous and later infamous. The ingredients for success and failure, all wrapped up in a nice package with the emotional stability of a Molotov cocktail. When I moved to L.A. in the late 70s and discovered cocaine, it only amplified these charming characteristics. I'm a runaway son of a nuclear A-bomb. But alcohol, acid, cocaine, they were just affairs. When I met heroin, it was true love. After we made it big, Motley Crue gave me more money than I knew what to do with. So naturally, I spent it on the only thing I wanted to do, drugs. Before the ban, I lived only for the music. After it started, I lived only for the drugs. Okay, so maybe Motley Crue gave me the resources to be an addict, but you know what? If it hadn't, I'd have found some other way to do it. I guess we all have to live out our destiny, even those of us who have to choose the worst one imaginable. So why did I take this strange dark trip? Well, I have a little 1-2-3 theory on this. 1, my childhood was shitty. My dad left when I was 3 and never came back. 2, my mom, she tried to love me, but every time a new guy came on the scene, I'd be in the way and she'd shuffle me off to live with my grandparents. And 3, I was born an addict. It's no surprise that I grew up feeling angry, unloved, and somehow needed revenge. Revenge on who? On the world? On myself? Welcome to my breakdown. I was always driven, even when I didn't know where I was going. Way before I met Tommy Lee, Vince Neil, and Mick Mars, I knew I would be in Motley Crue. I knew how we would look, and what we would sound like, and how we would behave. Fucking badly, obviously. Motley Crue was always about music and girls, music and drugs, and music and violence. We wanted to be the biggest, the dirtiest, the loudest rock band on the planet. We knew we were on our way in 1983 when we helicoptered in to play in front of 350,000 metal fans at a festival in Los Angeles. Our only gripe was that we should have been headlining. It was only a matter of time. We were on the highway to hell and had every bad intention of destroying anything and everything in our path. You could find us by the trail of sex, drugs, and rock and roll we left behind us. The one who searches and destroys. But two major things happened to me in 1983. Shout at the Devil went platinum and moved Motley Crue even further up the ladder. And I crashed my Porsche drunk, dislocated my shoulder, and started smoking heroin to numb the pain. The problem was I carried on smoking and then started injecting long after the pain was gone. Fuck, there were clues I was becoming a junkie. You'd need to be pretty self-obsessed to miss them. But if I was one thing back then, it was self-obsessed. When Vince Neil went to jail for 20 days, I didn't visit or phone or sing her once. It never even occurred to me. It would have been a waste of valuable drug time. By the end of the Theater of Pain tour in 1986, I was on my way to becoming a full-blown junkie. I had OD'd after a show in London, been left for dead in a garbage dumpster. I'd turned up strung out to be Tommy's best man at his wedding with syringes hidden in my cowboy boots, and I stayed home freebasing rather than attend my own grandmother's funeral, the woman who had loved me and who had raised me. And things, they were about to get worse. Much worse. Welcome to my breakdown. The strangest thing is that during the darkest, most lost time of my life, I kept diaries. At home, as I was cracking up or on tour, I scribbled down my thoughts in battered journals or on scraps of paper. Sometimes I wrote in them completely sober and sane. At other times, they were like the diary of a madman. I think that in my drug-addled, comatose mind, I felt my diary was the only person who really understood me. Maybe my only friend, someone to confide in? They don't say it's lonely at the top for nothing. I'd forgotten these diaries existed, or maybe I was in denial about them until I pulled them out of a storage locker last year, buried under my musty tour programs, magazine covers, and multi-platinum awards. They were genuinely shocking for me to read, a window back into a dark time in my life that I'd left behind a long time ago, hopefully never to return. As I write this, Motley Crue is back and playing all around the world again. I fucking love it. In some ways, life in the crew is as insane as ever. The amps are still too loud, and so is our attitude. I still love playing rock and roll. In fact, I can safely say it gets me high. I feel privileged to still be around to do what I love so much, and the fact that we still do it on our own terms is extremely fucking gratifying for me. The difference is I no longer come off stage from that adrenaline rush and launch into a kamikaze narcotics campaign to get even higher. Now the music and the fans are enough, just like it should be. I'm the same person, but I'm also a different one. You see, there's Sicky, and then there's Nikki. Many are sober, in control, rather than out of control and crazed. Occasionally, it even occurs to me that I may be the kind of